Canada's Indigenous leaders are seeking a public apology from Pope Francis over the Catholic Church's abuse of Native children in boarding schools. The United Arab Emirates says that Russian oil is needed by energy markets, and no producer can substitute this production. The U.S. and the Philippines hold massive joint military drills amid rising tensions with China over the disputed South China Sea. This is World News, a live broadcast from our Tehran headquarters with me, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Canada's Indigenous people are to meet with Pope Francis in the Vatican to ask for an apology for the Church's role in residential schools where Indigenous children were abused. More than 30 Indigenous elders and school survivors are meeting with the Pope on Monday and Friday. Canadian bishops say that they expect the Pope to address both the ongoing trauma and legacy of suffering faced by Indigenous people to this day. Last year, the remains of 215 children were discovered at the former Indian residential school in the western Canadian province of British Columbia. Hundreds more unmarked burial sites have been found ever since. The harrowing discovery brought new demands for accountability. The schools run mostly by the Catholic Church aim to assimilate Indigenous children between 1831 and 1996. Well, I've talked to journalist and political analyst John Bosnich, and he says the Catholic Church must apologize to the families of victims and compensate for what he describes as a transgenerational genocide.
The Pope must apologize. There is no alternative to that, and that is just the beginning. The Catholic Church has been involved in this actual transgenerational genocide in North and South America since its arrival in the area. There are hundreds of graves have been discovered, but there are definitely many more to be found. This took place more than a century, 150 years minimum of residential schools in which the children were not just mistreated, they were raped, they were murdered, and their bodies were purposely hidden. This is a genocide which continued for at least 10 generations of Native peoples. Pope's apology will just be chapter one of what must be a massive financial compensation, the ceding of churches, the closing of churches, and the return of lands to the Aboriginal peoples.
The UAE has poured more cold water on Western efforts to replace Russian energy. It says energy markets need Russian oil and no producer is able to substitute the production. The UAE energy minister says that OPEC Plus needs to stay together, stay focused, and not allow politics to distract the group. OPEC Plus consists of 23 countries, including Russia. Western nations, including the United States, have been trying to end or slash Europe's reliance on Russian energy in response to Moscow's military offensive against Ukraine. Russia is Europe's top oil and gas supplier. Just days ago, the Qatari energy minister also said that his country is currently unable to help Europe with gas deliveries, as there is no immediate alternative to Russia. Now on to the latest regarding a conflict between Russia and Ukraine. The two have agreed to open two humanitarian corridors to evacuate civilians from frontline areas, according to a Ukrainian official. Under the agreement, people will be allowed to leave the southern city of Mariupol in their cars. More than 3.8 million people have fled Ukraine since over a month ago. The UN says that around 90% of them are women and children, and most of them have fled to neighboring Poland. According to the UN Human Rights Office, over 1,100 civilians have been killed and 1,800 wounded. The world body says the true casualty figures are expected to be much higher. Ukraine has expressed readiness to discuss neutrality and non-nuclear status if it is backed by security guarantees from the Kremlin. Ukrainian president says that a deal with Russia is only possible if troops are withdrawn from his country. Volodymyr Zelensky also noted that he would like an all-for-all prisoner exchange with Russia and has handed over a list He added that Kyiv once compromised with Russia over eastern Donbass region. Zelensky says that he understands forcing Russia completely out of his country is impossible and would lead to a third world war. Now, we've talked to political commentator Scott Bennett about the Ukrainian president's readiness to discuss neutrality and non-nuclear status of his country.
I think if he has any semblance of rationality or intelligence, he has come to that conclusion, although he is a very mentally unbalanced and irrational person that is really going off the deep end in many, many respects. He's desperately trying to shame the United States and the United Kingdom into supplying weapons that and troops and anti-air defense materials that just are not going to arrive because the West and NATO does not want to engage in a suicidal war against Russia. The West knows very well that Russia's missile technology and their will to survive will far outweigh any petty commercial makeup wars that the West and NATO tries to engineer. And I think this is going to have a tremendous blowback as well as Russia begins to clean up the operation and it begins to counteract its kinetic operations with civil affairs and public relations campaigns to win the hearts and minds of the people. You're already witnessing countries like Serbia declaring their neutrality towards Russia and NATO. And that's going to be a prevailing trend, as we've discussed from the very beginning of this campaign. The emergence of neutrality as a foreign policy is going to dominate the Eastern European and post-Soviet Republic satellite countries.
Ukrainian intelligence chief says that Russia is trying to split the country into two sections, as happened with North and South Koreas. Bodanov says that Russia is trying to create a Moscow control region in Ukraine after failing to take over the whole country. He added that Ukrainian forces will soon launch guerrilla warfare against Russia. Now, this, as a European Research Institute says, nearly half of Ukrainians aged 18 to 55 are ready to fight Russia. According to the survey, around 47% of respondents say that they would be willing to join direct military combat in fortified defense positions of the Ukrainian forces. Now, in other news, the U.S. and the Philippines have started their largest ever joint military drills amid tensions with China over the South China Sea. The exercise involves 9,000 American and Filipino troops that will last 2 weeks. The maneuvers by the two countries focus on potential conflict in the South China Sea. The strategic waters have been a scene of frequent encounters between Chinese and Filipino patrol vessels in recent months. Beijing claims the sea almost its entirety, but Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, and Vietnam are among regional countries that have competing claims over the South China Sea. The North Korean leader says that his country will continue to reinforce defense capabilities, promising to build a formidable striking force and overwhelming military prowess. Kim Jong-un says that only unstoppable military power can prevent a war, ensure the security of the country, and deter threats and blackmail by imperialists. He made a comment during a meeting with scientists and technocrats involved in the Thursday launch of the country's largest intercontinental ballistic missile. In response, Washington imposed fresh sanctions on Pyongyang. It also imposed sanctions on Russian individuals and entities, accusing them of providing sensitive materials for North Korean missile program. Pyongyang has tested nearly a dozen weapons this year. Our Seoul correspondent Frank Smith explains why North Korea has recently intensified its missile tests.
And we've seen also a diversification of North Korea's missile arsenal, with hypersonic missiles and cruise missiles being added to their sort of catalog of missile capabilities. Now, the reason that we're seeing this, you know, uptick in North Korea's missile development is that over the past few years, following the failed summitry between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and former U.S. President Donald Trump, Kim Jong-un really hasn't received anything. He has kept his word to have a moratorium on long-range missile tests and nuclear tests, with the understanding that the U.S. would respond with a relief of United Nations Security Council sanctions and overtures toward meaningful negotiations between the U.S. and North Korea that really haven't materialized. Also, it's a message to South Korea, which has a new president that's set to be inaugurated in May.
The Yemeni government announces a new prisoner swap deal with the Saud-led coalition, including high-profile figures from the former government. The head of National Committee for Prisoner Affairs says that the deal was agreed earlier this month with the support of the UN. Abdelkader al-Murtada says that the swap deal includes 1,400 Ansarullah members in return for 823 prisoners that include the brother of the former Yemeni president, Mansour Hadi, and former defense minister. The official said that the deal awaits an exchange of lists of prisoners on Tuesday. Meantime, a senior UN official in Yemen says that no final deal has been reached between the two sides on the prisoner exchange lists, and discussions are going on. On Saturday, Yemen announced the unilateral ceasefire, declaring its readiness for a full prisoner swap. Israeli crop duster planes have sprayed toxic herbicides on Gaza farmlands as Tel Aviv continues its inhumane acts of aggression against the impoverished region. Farmers in Gaza see no end in sight to their suffering. Dashrav Shannon has a report.
In yet another act of Israeli aggression against the Palestinians of Gaza, Israeli planes sprayed toxic chemicals on the eastern perimeter of the coastal enclave. Israeli crop duster planes sprayed herbicides at least twice this week on Gaza farming areas. The Israeli regime regularly sprays Palestinian agricultural lands near the so-called buffer zone with dangerous substances which destroy the crops. For more than a decade, Israeli planes sprayed Gaza's farmlands several times a year, destroying various crops.
The Israelis spread herbicides to the farmers' land beside the border in order to prevent them to plant in their land, to bush the farmers out of their land and leave their land without any trees in order to feed them for their food security and for their children.
Spraying unknown toxic substances on Gaza's farmlands may have long-lasting effects on the environment. Gazan farmers say they are struggling to make ends meet due to Israel's inhumane practices.
Israel sprays our farmlands with poison. The chemicals that they spray don't kill the weed on the fence. They only kill our crops. We suffer heavy losses when Israel sprays our land because it's killing our crops and poisoning our farmlands.
Israel claims that it sprays what it described as weed killers for security reasons, but experts say the Israeli regime aims to destroy the livelihoods of farmers.
Using such herbicides on Gaza Strip by the Israelis, it's kind of offensive towards the Palestinian farmers. At the same time, towards the Palestinian food security, these areas are feeding the Palestinians with the needed vegetables and other kinds.
Rights groups say the suffering of farmers and their families in Gaza reflects the scope of Israeli human rights violations.
Gazan farmers have been hit hard by the Israeli blockade and wars since 2007. Now experts say that Israel's poisoning of crops will make a bad situation worse and harm vital sources of food in the territory. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The French presidential election has been unlike any other in recent memory, with apathy and disinterest dominating headlines. It's the first major vote in the West since the end of the COVID. And that may explain why France appears unusually politically disoriented. From Paris, Rami Mazahri has more.
France goes to the polls in just 2 weeks in an election marked by major disinterest and discontent over a lack of discussion on worsening domestic issues. Abstention is expected to reach 30%. The last time so few voters turned out was 2002, when the far-right National Front shockingly made it to the second round. Many wonder if this election, the surging left may stage a similar surprise, with Jean-Luc Mélenchon now approaching the far-right's Marine Le Pen in the battle to make it past the first round. The so-called bourgeois bloc of voters is highly motivated to win re-election for Emmanuel Macron, so he seems certain to make it to the final round. He has avoided debates and public appearances, preferring to focus on Ukraine, as his tenure has been marked by a record number of corruption scandals economic inequality, and unprecedented political repression.
We are here to protest against the abusive government and this kingship presidency of Emmanuel Macron. The Yellow Vests are here to promote a true vision of democracy and to redistribute our nation's wealth. Every election there is more and more abstention because people don't believe in mainstream politics anymore.
In 2017, the two mainstream political parties, dogged by corruption scandals, were ousted for the first time since Charles de Gaulle. In 2012, optimism was sky high that François Hollande was going to end austerity and stand up to Berlin and Brussels. But in this election, France, a rare Western country known for high levels of political engagement, appears to be exhausted by politics. A vast and intimidating police presence at demonstrations won't encourage political gatherings either.
Everyone here can feel the intimidation towards the Yellow Vests. Look at how cops are surrounding us before we even start. We're the only protesters who get treated like this, except for neo-Nazi rallies. But we aren't neo-Nazis or a political party. We're simply the people.
Unions have just pulled out their big gun, an unlimited strike for Paris public transport. That strike has confusingly been stopped after just one day, perhaps showing that France remains in a state of confusion even so close to the election. France has only just ended its coronavirus restrictions, and the lack of political interest appears to show that the country hasn't really gotten back to normal. Western polls have been notoriously inaccurate, however, and sky-high inflation may play a crucial part when voters decide about the next 5 years. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
In lockstep with the spring, the season of renewal and freshness, and the greening of nature, we here at IRIB English Radio wish you happiness, prosperity, and good health. Economic divide.
The world energy markets, as a result of the war in Ukraine, have been thrown into a mayhem. The U.S. and the Europeans are pressuring Russia, albeit in different degrees. But have we entered a new world energy order due to the Ukraine conflict post-Putin? Hi, I'm Kavitar Vahey, and in this edition of Economic Divide, we will look at how the world energy landscape has changed, maybe for good. Coming up in this program, the U.S. has barred Russian oil imports, looking for alternatives. Meanwhile, Europe has diverged from the U.S., announcing that by mid-May, we will come up with a proposal to get off Russian oil, gas, and coal by 2027. Was there a divergence there? Next up, the U.S. left in a cold. Well, Russia's partnership with the top oil producers like Saudi Arabia, jointly leading the OPEC coalition, has so far stayed intact, but the U.S. pressure has not worked. Does that mean that the U.S. is left out in the cold as a result? And then finally, the new world energy order emerging after Putin. Is this what we are looking at as a result of the Ukraine conflict? Are fresh alliances and blocs aligning with each other from West Asia to Russia itself and beyond? Is an Eastern pivot taking shape?
The crisis between Russia and Ukraine has already disrupted energy and financial markets, pushing industrialized nations in Europe and North America to stabilize rising oil prices. Amid threats of an oil embargo, Russia says that it could potentially sell that oil elsewhere, perhaps to China or India. Analysts believe energy imports from Russia will not be quickly replaced. Even if countries release their strategic petroleum reserves and the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, pumps more oil, prices are likely to stay high.
There is no capacity in the world at the moment that can replace 7 million barrels of exports, assuming that we are going to lose a volume of that region. Some are even, my colleagues are even talking of maybe 8 million when you put crude products, other liquids. The world simply does not have the capacity. So it's not about market share now. It's how do we mitigate? How do we overcome this crisis?
Amid the chaos, the U.S. president has reached out to its allies in the Persian Gulf region to ramp up production to tame the prices. But the reports indicate that the leaders of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have declined calls. However, the UAE's ambassador to Washington has said the country wants to increase oil production and will encourage the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, to ramp up supply. Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Kuwait could potentially ramp up production by 2.1 million barrels per day from current levels within a couple of months. Last week, OPEC Plus, which includes Russia, declined to increase oil production despite Western treaties. Reports of frigid communications with Saudi Arabia come as the Biden administration seeks to increase oil supply after formally banning Russian oil imports.
The Ukraine conflict has definitely caused a major shift in how to replace Russian energy supplies, like oil and even commodities like wheat. But if the world, or should I say the U.S., and to some degree Europe, is moving on this track, won't that spell a new world energy order? Let's see what people had to say about this online. This is what the U.S. Special Presidential Envoy for Climate, John Kerry, had to say about migration and actually food production. Biden's climate czar John Kerry on migration said, wait until you see 100 million people for whom the entire food production capacity has collapsed. Now, this entry actually points to an incentive behind the U.S. and Europe in keeping this war going, although it can't be really proven, but it could be a likely scenario. I can't tweet this enough. Nathaniel Rothschild is desperate to keep the snake's head and is requesting governments up their game to defeat in order to save the world. This war is between Europe and the EU against Russia. Now, as energy markets are rattled by the interruption in the available supplies, this entry may nail it on the head. A new world energy order is emerging from Putin's war in Ukraine. This entry quoted what is said to be something that is going on regarding the world energy crisis. And of course, it represents a redrawing of the energy and geopolitical map in Europe. Taking a look finally at this particular post, we have been telling you on this program about the following, and the Ukraine conflict may prove our point. This particular viewer agrees with us. He goes on to say, what is unfolding right now is only starting and will change the world order for good. Russia, China will be an integrated new power bloc that has ample natural resources, ample labor force, growing energy consumption per capita, ample ability to produce goods and services. Okay, some of the viewer posts there. Well, let's now bring in a guest for this section of the Q&A. We have brought in Pai Ian, who's an independent political and economic researcher from Los Angeles, who joins us here. Pai Ian, welcome to the program. Looking at what is happening with oil, $200 a barrel is what we're looking at as possibilities for the oil prices to hit. Now, the U.S. president has tried to contact Saudi Arabia and the UAE, but they're not even returning their calls, his calls. And at the same time, the UAE has said OPEC needs to decide on whether it's going to ramp up production. What are your thoughts when it comes to the energy crisis that's happening here?
I mean, this is all further geopolitical and geoeconomic theater. Basically, no one in Saudi Arabia runs Saudi Arabia, and the same goes for the UAE for that matter. They're both satellite states run from the city of London, which remains the financial capital of the world. It's theater also because oil, quote unquote, prices are therefore set from the city of London, just as the gold price is, and for monetarily related reasons. Energy prices cannot be relegated to the whims of OPEC, which reports to London, New York, and Swiss banks, let alone to any credible notion of a quote-unquote free market dictated by supposed supply and demand. Oil prices are thus hiked tactically by the banks in charge of petrodollar reserve recycling in order to cushion their capital coffers just before major asset consolidation waves.
Okay, by Ian there. We, at this point, will bring in Koichiro Tanaka, who's a professor at Keio University. He joins us from Tokyo. Koichiro Tanaka, welcome. It's really strange how the U.S. is called energy dependent, but at the same time, it can't even help itself. I mean, taking a look at the U.S. oil industry as it is exists today, it seems like it can't ramp up its oil production beyond just a limited period of time. Tell us why there's then that situation when it comes to U.S. oil capacity in production.
Well, I think it's the difficulty that the United States or any free economy would face. These oil producers or oil companies in the United States are not national or state-owned enterprises. They are totally private. So when they see that the oil prices are low or that they see that an unfavorable condition or circumstance is arising, then they would cut their production or even cut their investment. So it's quite difficult comparing the U.S. system or the U.S. economy with the economy like Russia or China. Now, the shale industry in the United States requires a lot of investment and preparation to expand and maintain or even maintain its output.
Our info news section is upon us, and there were plenty of news from around the world to cover. Well, our first entry takes us to the UK. Energy shortages worldwide. UK is not immune to it, and it's experiencing a very severe one. Now, we've talked about this, but this charity has issued a warning about the cost of living in that country. Rural communities are without access to gas. Therefore, as a consequence, they're facing a tsunami of poverty. And because of that, there are calls on the government to help out, because 14%, that's 14% of UK households, are off-grid without access to main gas. So obviously a big problem for that country. Next up, inflation, the UK conflict to make inflation last longer. Is that going to be the case? It appears that that would be the case. There's a 50-50 chance of that happening. Aside from the energy shortage worldwide as a result of this, you're having things like food shortages also contribute to inflation. That has been going on for quite some time, food costs going up. But wheat, as a result of the shortage that's caused by having these sanctions on Russia, contributes to that. Moving on, Russian loan defaults. Yeah, that's a problem. Russian sanctions are causing creditors to really get worried because they could lose billions in Russian loans. Well, obviously, Russia being such a top producer when it comes to, for example, energy, just as one example, for one particular field, it has obviously opted for loans in the past. And so creditors are the ones that may lose out on that. And that's a big problem because that then also can contribute to inflation, believe it or not. And finally, poverty in the Americas. We figure we go to that part of the world. You have 5 million people who are in extreme poverty and are highly exposed to disasters as a result of that, whether directly or indirectly. So the Americas has a poverty problem. Not that anywhere around the world this poverty isn't there, but it's been persistent. 86 million people actually live in extreme poverty in the Americas. And when we talk about the Americas, we're talking about Latin America and also the Caribbean nations as a result. Those were the topics that we picked. So hopefully it's something that you liked. But in particular, we're looking for what you have to propose to us. That's what we look forward to. So send us any comments or suggestions that you may have. We'll make sure that we cover it in this program.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
You've heard about a new world order, hopefully, but how about a new world energy order? That is something which is now being talked about, which is the subject of our in-depth section. Okay, first let's take a look at the 27-nation bloc that is called the European Union. Now, although the EU is confused about whether it can actually disconnect from Russian energy, it has responded and it has gone ahead and actually speeded up its disconnection from Russian gas. At least they are trying to do that, and that's a big question mark. Now, in the meantime, the U.S. has barred Russian oil imports and is searching for alternative energy supplies. OPEC countries in particular, Saudi Arabia, for example, at this point, aside from Saudi Arabia, the OPEC countries, they are basking in the high oil prices after prices collapsed 2 years ago. Now, when the U.S. reached out to the UAE and Saudi Arabia, not only did they not take the call, later the UAE said, whatever OPEC decides for an increase in production, that is when we'll do it, even though the UAE said that it would on its own perhaps go for production, an increase in production. Well, in order to understand the gravity of the situation, this is how this particular person has actually described this. This represents the biggest redrawing of the energy and geopolitical map in Europe and possibly the world since the collapse of the Soviet Union, if not the end of World War II, obviously in reference to the conflict in Ukraine. He goes on to say, in terms of what the outcome will be, the outcome could be a sequel to the Cold War. Bob McNally is his name. He's the president of Rapidan Energy Group, and he was also a White House official, a former White House official. Now, let's move on to Ian Bremmer. You may have heard of him. He's appeared on many talk shows. President of the Eurasia Group, he believes in the New World Energy Order, and he actually names Germany as an example. Let's take a listen to him.
I think that this is a tipping point. Won't end globalization, but it does end the peace dividend. It does mean that the Europeans overnight will and must prioritize spending on defense, policy on national security, coordination on NATO. The speech that was given by Olaf Scholz, the new chancellor, 2 weeks ago, in my view, the most significant speech given by a European leader in the post-Cold War environment.
Okay, he says, as you heard him there, days after Russia actually sent its forces into Ukraine, he referred to Germany. Well, the chancellor is Olaf Scholz, in which he announced, as Ian Bremmer just said, a massive increase in Germany's defense budget, along with plans to pursue greater energy security. Now, at the center of this rapprochement that happened with the former Soviet Union and then obviously Russia, you have oil and gas links that are central to political engagements. So this is what Ostpolitik, why are we talking about this? Well, because Germany, to decouple from Russia, is going to be tough, but it's gone ahead. Don't forget, the halt of the $11 billion Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline is just one of the most visible signs. All right, let's bring in some analysis into this. Let me introduce our guest for this section. We have with us Scott Ritter, a former UN Iraq weapons inspector who joins us. Scott Ritter, welcome. Looking at the shifts that are underway, they've been described as inflaming old grievances by one particular analyst, but at the same time, this is an opportunity, this shift in the world order for fresh alliances and blocs that are aligning with each other. What is this new world order that is arising because of the energy shifts, tectonic shifts that's been described?
Here, now, as the West seeks to divorce itself from Russia, the number two energy producer in the world, this isn't just an economic question, but a geopolitical question. This is not just about trying to isolate Russia. This is about Russia trying to isolate the West. This is about Russia saying that we reject the rules-based international order that the United States has shoved down the world's throat since the end of the Second World War. This is about Russia saying we're willing to work with nations like China, India, Pakistan, Iran, South Africa, Brazil, Mexico, and others to create a multipolar world that revolves around the notion of a law-based international order, and that law being the United Nations Charter, something the United States helped draft but has been assiduously ignoring us ever since then. So we're looking at a fundamental realignment of the world away from, you know, the American-centric universe that had existed to a multipolarity. Whether or not this shift will be successful, we don't know. The United States and Europe may still hold enough cards to beat back for the moment.
Okay, great. Let's bring in another analysis into this. We are looking here at having Pai Ian rejoins us. He's the independent political and economic researcher. Pai Ian, welcome back. So the U.S. Going as far into the Americas, reaching out to Venezuela to speak to a government that it doesn't even officially recognize to see if it could maybe have them facilitate oil production and have it inject into the oil production for the world, really. But do you think that that is going to, A, happen, and B, maybe an ulterior motive might be for the U.S. to drive a wedge between Venezuela and Russia to, I guess, break that relationship?
Yes, wedge geopolitics is indeed at work, and yet is nothing new. Consider how Kissinger and Nixon drove a wedge between the Soviet Union and China 5 decades ago. Atlanticists have been trying to reprise that act for years, but to reverse effects, as Russia and China are practically married now. Hence, trying to patch things up in rushed fashion with Venezuela and Iran partly represents shrewd means of trying to reintegrate those nations as means of energy supply, pricing, and trading back onto a fully petrodollar recycling-based fold between New York and London. That aspect is transparent, however, to both Caracas and Tehran, and they're essentially both on board Eurasian alternatives to the petrodollar, for what that's worth.
The current energy crisis has highlighted the importance of other major energy producers, which have been shunned by Western powers. Just last week, U.S. officials met Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro in Caracas for the first bilateral talks in years, even though the U.S. does not officially recognize the Maduro government. U.S. officials have demanded Venezuela supply at least a portion of oil exports to the U.S. as part of any agreement to ease oil trading sanctions on OPEC member nations. Venezuela is a Russian ally and has the world's largest oil reserves. U.S. officials made clear their priority was to secure supplies for the United States. Prospects of more oil exports by Venezuela comes amid reports of Iran's comeback to the energy markets. The JCPOA revival talks could bring a significant volumes of Iranian oil back to the market. Caracas and Tehran would have been unlikely sources of relief for a U.S.-led Western alliance before Russia's military operation in Ukraine. Before sanctions were applied on Iran, produced about 4 million barrels per day.
The U.S. has once again miscalculated its oil plans, and none was more evident by the outreach it made at places otherwise unthinkable. Yet, it failed to see that the new world energy order was taking place. It was a geopolitical alignment that the U.S. was hoping for, reaching out to Venezuela, a sanctions-destroyed U.S. adversary, and an afterthought for the Biden administration. The Biden administration did not even recognize the Maduro government officially. Yet, it may now ease sanctions in return for pumping more of its oil. Yet, the U.S. may have a sinister plan in mind. Drive a wedge, or better yet, pull Venezuela out of Russia's orbit. The less allies, the worse for Putin. Yet that was a long shot. Then comes another communication the U.S. made with what it considers allies, and that was to Saudi Arabia and the UAE, but that also fell short. According to multiple sources, Saudi Arabia and the UAE leaders did not even return Biden's calls, dashing hopes for Biden asking for their contribution to the oil glut. Additionally, Biden was hoping to get a united front against Russia with these two countries. U.S. attempts, however, have come out short. Saudi Arabia has long been disappointed with deteriorating relationship with the U.S. since Biden was sworn in, but it has had a good relationship with Russia. More and more West Asian nations, like Saudi Arabia, have realized that the U.S.'s focus outside of West Asia means they have to align themselves more to where their interests lie. And that means in pivoting to the East. The U.S. confrontation with Russia may be something that it is gearing up to do against China. Saudi Arabia is most likely well aware of that and will not risk its relationship with China. After all, China is Saudi Arabia's top economic trading partner because China is the biggest importer of Saudi oil. Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are the dominant economic players in West Asia, and that plays an important factor in not only their alignment, but other countries in the region as well. Both countries account for more than half of the region's imports and exports. This may pave the way for other countries to follow their lead. That does it for me for this section of the program. Until next time.
The world as we know it may have changed because of the Ukraine conflict, practically as soon as the operation started. At least that is what it seems like, but that is a misconception, since the geopolitical shifts have actually been happening for quite some time. To say that a new world energy order is emerging from the Ukraine conflict, that's true, but Europe has realized it can't accompany the U.S. on this energy decoupling from Russia. And all the signs are there that the U.S. will be left out in the cold, since Russia and many other countries, including the EU, are gravitating more and more towards the East, with stronger alliances formed as a result. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you. Always looking forward to your suggestions or your questions. From Mikhail Tahwei and the entire team, it's goodbye until the next program.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
for humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salamullah, which are found through his sermons and his letters. Amongst the human rights charter that we can derive is found in the letter that he sent to Malik al-Ashtar, one of his commanders, when he sent him as a governor to Egypt. Amongst the interesting parts of this letter that was given to Malik, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullahi alayhi, obviously his main aim of this letter is that Malik applies it and makes sure that the rights of people are given to them. Because Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he did not become a leader, nor did he become a khalifa, so he could indulge himself with the wealth of people, or he can indulge himself with the concept that now he's in power and he's a powerful person and everyone has to submit to him and everyone is his servant. That never crossed the mind of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. Rather, when he became a khalifa himself, he said, I can only become a khalifa just to apply the justice and the laws of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You accept, I can be at your service. You refuse, then I'm out. And people accepted. So when he gave this letter to Malik, the core of this letter is to serve the people. So this was a reminder to Malik and instructions to Malik how he can apply justice and give people their right. Now, like I said, amongst the things that Amir al-Mu'mineen said in this letter is when he chooses his chief of justice. And that's a very important position to have in our society, because the rights of people, obviously, when people collide with one another, they end up in a court of law. And the court of law, if those who are running it corrupt, then obviously people's right will not be met. So he says to him, select as your chief justice from the people, obviously. But anyone, can I select anyone to be a chief of justice? Amir al-Mu'mineen says, no, he has to have specific criteria, a specific character. Otherwise, he will take the rights of people. He says to him, one who is by far the best amongst them. Don't choose anyone. Choose the one who is the best. One who is not obsessed with domestic worries. One who cannot be intimidated. One who does not err too often. So obviously there's a list that needs to be met. And among this list, obviously he needs the best of them. Now, in our current times, when we want to choose a chief of justice, obviously we have to get someone who's qualified, has qualifications. And these days, most people, when they become in power, like the president or the prime minister, when they want to select their cabinet, a lot of them, they just select them randomly or based because they know them or what have you. They're not based on skills or based on the fact they are the best in that field. Rather, sometimes I've seen in some countries I would not like to mention, actually they bring the worst and they expect the government and people to have their rights. Let us take a short break and then we come back.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at English Radio at irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So Amir ibn Salamullah alayhi says to him, when you select your chief of justice, make sure you select the one who is the best, the one who cannot be intimidated, which is a very fair point, because if we bring someone who is a coward, who could be intimidated by the people themselves or by the people he wants to judge, then obviously he's not going to apply justice, is he? He's going to be scared, and then therefore he will not apply justice. And we've seen plenty of movies in this regard. Or the one who makes too much mistakes. Sometimes we have good people, right, in terms of qualifications, but they make too much mistakes. And sometimes if you put someone in power and position, and you see that he made many mistakes, it's time to remove him because he's no longer good. He's no longer serving the people. So he needs to be removed. And then Amir al-Mu'minin Salamullah says, one who is not self-centered, because power itself, it has that power itself to blind people, to overcome their mind, to consume them. And once they are consumed by this power, of power, they become self-centered. They only care about themselves. They do not care about people anymore. So should we have such people in the court system or as a chief justice? Obviously no. Then the Imam says to him, one who will not grow receptive over the arguments of advocates and who will not examine, and who will examine with patience and every new disclosure of fact, and who will be strictly impartial in his decision. So obviously, if you want to put a person in court as a judge or chief justice, he has to thoroughly examine the case, not just pass judgment very quickly, as we've seen many examples in history. And even now, many people get accused falsely, and because the court does not decide to look at the evidence that's been provided to them, or they are biased. And, you know, sometimes it's funny how when we look at cases now, when we look at people who are good people, but because some country deems them to be terrorists, they are condemned. Now, obviously, they're not examining everything. Obviously, they're not looking at the bigger picture. Obviously, they're not looking at it from an open mind. And surely, they are not being patient as well. So Amir al-Mu'minin Salamullah alayhi, he says to Malik, when you need to place a person as a chief justice, a person who will apply justice to people, he needs to fit the criteria. And Amir al-Mu'minin, mind you, he mentions many other things that I have no time to read, yet alone explain. So in order for people to get the rights, and in order for justice to be maintained, the right people must be selected. The best of people must be selected in terms of knowledge, in terms of piety, in terms of self-control. Those are the ones that we should seek and put them in a place of chief justice so they can at least try to give back to society and create justice for all. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله.
What you heard was an IRIB English Radio program.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.